It is Saturday, the 13th of April, 2024, and this is The Future of Photography.
The Future of Photography.
Hey, Jeremiah, how you doing?
I'm doing okay. Doing okay from cloudy California this morning. And, all is calm and all is bright.
Okay, well, that's good. It's actually spring has sprung here in the UK. It's warm and sunny. And like a week ago, there was, you know, horrendous rainstorms. And now it's nice. So
everyone's out on the street wearing shorts and T-shirts now?
Probably, except that I haven't been out because we have a new puppy. And so I have to stay in the house looking after the puppy quite a lot. But that's all good, right? Anybody on the Discord has seen the photos of the puppy. So
yeah, you have a permanent photo model now.
I do, yes, I do.
Any camera, any lens, any edits, you can always take pictures.
Do you know what? I think we need to do a show about that, because I'd love for what you just said to be true. My lived experience is absolutely the opposite. My lived experience is I only know one way of taking a photograph of this puppy because she moves so quickly. I'm not going to give it away just now. Let's do it next week or something like that, right?
Yes, I'll give you a tip so that next week you can take some better pictures. What you do, just put a little peanut butter on your head.
On my head, okay.
on your head, on your third eye, and right, the puppy will come pretty close.
Okay, so that's interesting. I have seen, I think I mentioned it on my review of the photography show. There's a dog photography lady who is often there, who uses Perspex. So a sheet of clear Perspex with some peanut butter on, and then that's how you get the shot of the dog looking like it's licking the lens. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, because it's peanut butter. Anyway, that's not my secret to taking photos of my puppy. We'll have another conversation about that. Today we're going to talk about scale, which
we are.
I'm looking forward to. Tell us about scale.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about scale in terms of cameras. In other words, little tiny pocket cameras, even half the size of a iPhone. And we can talk about lenses, big, small, etc., pancake, telephoto. We can talk about the print, small, medium, large, extra large, billboard size, etc. So scale will basically determine a lot of the aesthetic of a picture and the response to that. In other words, you can use a small camera, like a Minox, very grainy, and blow it up massively. And that will create a very interesting, albeit somewhat balanced between abstract and and realistic. Or you could take a 4x5 photo with a semi-large camera and contact print that to a small image that is crisp. So scale is very, very important, just in terms of how we experience photography in all its value.
So, yeah, it's interesting you mentioned about film formats there. Yeah, which is cool. I used to have a Pentax Auto 110, which I think at the time it was released billed itself as the world's smallest SLR. It was an SLR. It had interchangeable lenses, which was like tiny little things, and it took 110 film, of course. So that was good fun. But then, yeah.
Question: Was it so small you kept losing the lenses?
No, it wasn't actually. They weren't but they were, they were only an inch across in diameter, you know, so they were pretty small lenses. But it was a fun camera. It was just a bit of fun. It was great. I don't have it anymore. It went years ago when I had a bit of a clear out, And then on the digital side, of course, I tend to shoot even smaller than that. Well, of course, phone sensors would be way smaller than that. my treasured Olympus Tough camera. It has a very small sensor. I don't even know what size it is, other than it's small. And then, right, you know, what's the biggest digital you get these days? Mostly it's the 44 by 55 mil, isn't it? In a mainstream camera. As a sensor size.
Yeah, I think it would be what the Fuji does or whatnot. I mean, of course, yeah. Hasselblad and Phase One, those are as big as they get, I think.
Yeah.
And then I'll kind of address that a little later in my picks. So I have one of those larger capture.
One of those larger capture cameras. Okay, so that's cool. So tell me then, because for me, I'm very focused at the other end of the workflow these days. I am less fussed entirely about the capture end because I'm still indulging in a fairly graphical style of photography. I like what do you like at the output end of the workflow?
Well, let's talk about the input first. In terms of capture, I mean, I travel across China. And I used this is just before iPhones were popular or came into being, with a Sony. It was no bigger than a credit card, this camera, digital camera,
yeah,
5 megapixels. I totally blanked on the model number. And it was like so thin that I could slip it into my back pocket. I could be very discreet about it. And I was traveling in areas that were really off the beaten path in Western China.
Right.
In the mountains.
Yeah.
And I didn't, A, want to travel with a lot of big gear. Number two, I didn't want to kind of enter into these communities with a big lens in front of my face, which really is a distracting or separating element.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially if you're moving through. Not if, you know, you're going to experience a community, you could be there for a while, and then the act of having a camera and a big lens in front of your face doesn't separate you because they now are familiar. But
yes,
I shot photos, I came back, processed them, printed them. And they're absolutely beautiful. I mean, I obviously spent time editing them, not only the images, but the kinds of quality that I was able to draw out. Mm-hmm. I was extremely happy. And that was a very small digital camera. My smallest film camera is a Minox, which I still have. Always referred to as the spy camera.
Yeah, the James Bond camera, right? Sean Connery and stuff like that. Yeah, yeah.
And you know, so that was great. And there's all different forms of experiences as you move from a small, you know, 16 millimeter size frame, tiny, to a more robust 35 millimeter, to a medium format, to a, you know, a plate camera, 4x5 camera, and 8x10 camera, etc. Those experiences are one, I believe, of, and we've talked about this before, slowing the process down. The larger the capture medium, the slower the intake. In other words, you spend more time in capture. I'm not saying that that's good, bad, or indifferent. It's just a different experience. You're not going to try and capture fleeting moments of your puppy with a 8x10 camera.
No, no.
Unless, I wouldn't do that. Plan for it, right?
So tell me
with
then.
With the old peanut butter.
Yeah. Is there, you go through a lot of peanut butter with a camera that size. Is there, for me, I've noticed that the size of the capture, the size of the sensor, be it digital or analog, right, is it actually influences the composition, and also the size of the output can drastically affect the impact of the composition. So I have a friend who shoots large format, and I remember years and years ago going to see an exhibition of his and thinking to myself, this is some great photography, but there's no way it would work if you shot it at 35 mil and printed it 6x4. It needed, it was imagery that needed to be, you know, 2 feet across, or a meter square or something like that. You know, it needed to be that size because the composition was such that the scale and the I guess the geometry of the composition just wouldn't have made any sense if it was any smaller. And I can only imagine that that was only able to be captured on something like an 8x10 camera, where actually the way that you are composing is on a large ground glass. Is that something that you've experienced, that the scale of the capture, especially the view when you're capturing, influences the composition?
Yeah, very, very much. Having used basically most formats, I celebrate each one in its own way. So, for example, we were talking off mic about using a Minox with very grainy fast film and blowing those images up massively. So what you then get is a pointillist Seurat type image that is abstract, kind of poetic. If it's even with a slow shutter speed, even the blurring or the non-focus of it, the randomness of how the grain is interpreted when it's blown up and not disguising itself. So the actual aesthetic of the chemistry involved. And the same would go for noise, what we would call noise on digital. And kind of leaning into that as an aesthetic choice. Of course, no image, you know, comes out of the camera is exactly the way it is presented. There's editing involved, whether it's small or massive in terms of how you output it. So I think that being aware of the limitations or the celebration of an aesthetic capture is something that I think is really fun to explore. And you can do that with any camera. Like, for example, if you took out your 35 millimeter camera or just a regular DSLR or mirrorless and basically shot only in the center of it. In other words, composed with imaginary frame lines in the center so that you just ignored everything. And when you put it onto your computer and you would blow it up so that the actual composition is in the center, and just experience and experiment with the noise or grain as a choice. And that's kind of fun. Ditto if you're using a large plate camera or an 8x10 and contact printing that and not blowing it up. There is something so crystal clear and sharp about that obviously is very inviting. On the other hand, you can take that 8x10 plate and blow it way up, and that becomes impactful in and of itself. And there is a discussion which we should follow on with, which is anything diminished by scaling it up? So that's an interesting question.
Well, let's So there's a lot in what you've just said there. So yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there's nothing quite like looking at an 8x10 contact print, because until you've seen one, you know, for listeners that haven't seen one ever, try and get to see one, because there's nothing quite like it. You can't quite imagine just how much you can see until you see one of those. I think before we go on to the scaling bit, I think my own experiences of shooting, do you know what really gets me is when I shoot Instax, because you know then that it's, especially the Instax Mini, that really impacts the way that I compose, because if you want anything to be visible in that shot, which is the size of a credit card, but you know, within the borders of a credit card, then you have to make a point of composing for the format because you haven't got any choices, right?
Do you find it hard to do that? Like, I found it very, very hard to make formal frame line composition using a Minox or a very small, basically a small format camera, very tiny. So, but
it does depend.
That's an advantage.
It is. In other words, it is an advantage. So there's an element of, for me, of. And I know this is all part of the culture of Instax and advertising around it, but I think for me one of the best examples there is a Holger, where you're never quite sure what's going to happen when you click the shutter, and you've got very little if you're close up on something with a Holger, you've got no idea really where the parallax is going to kick in and where it's not or anything like that. Instax cameras I find it challenging to do formal stuff. But as you say, you've got to lean in and celebrate the capture medium. And for me, that's both the camera and the film or sensor, and just go with it. And, and just enjoy what you get out of it, because many of us have the luxury of having lots of cameras to choose from, right? So if you want to do something that's loads and loads of detail, well, go and get your biggest sensor camera, right? If you want to do something that is a little bit more graphical, go and get something small and clunky.
Here's an interesting thought experiment for those who are interested in sort of group photo walks and all of that stuff. I know you are, Adrian. Is to get a table and put down all manner of cameras, from an 8x10 camera to a Minox, through a tiniest, roughest digital, let's say 10 cameras, 10 people, each numbered, and put those numbers into a hat, have everybody draw a number, and that assigns the camera to them, and then go on the walk, select a subject, and have everyone photograph that with the cameras that they drew from. Having done that, then swap it around.
Okay. Yeah.
It would be a wonderful group show.
It would.
Because I'm of the school that I feel that I could take an interesting, may not be great, but an interesting photograph with any camera that someone gave to me.
Which is a great luxury itself, and a great skill, no doubt, come from years of experimenting. So, that would be a really interesting format to go for, actually, for a photo walk. I can see that being a lot of fun, especially if, as you say, you rotate them so everybody gets a chance to have a go with every camera and just see what happens.
Yeah.
So, interesting. It's interesting.
And so I think one of the things we're talking about is truly understanding the limitations of the camera itself and using those limitations to express yourself freely. And so the limitations of an 8x10 camera is you can't run and gun. You can't handhold it effectively. You need to use a tripod. And that provokes thought and compositional formalism and all the rest of it. Waiting for the light, being patient, and creating something. And also maybe if you are have an understanding of the history of those kinds of imagery and, who shot what when, in a historical way. And so that will create the environment within which to use that large camera. And so there is that aesthetic, culture, history, and your own kind of input into what you're doing. And obviously, if you have an old Leica M3 with Tri-X film and you're out on the street, there's a there's more of a kind of, look at that, capture it quickly and with less thinking and more instinct. And so there is, once you just really figure out the, you know, the advantage of what you're using. Obviously, if you have a little Instax in your, you know, in your kit, you pull it out, and the feedback of the camera and the picture is going to determine the kind of quality of light, and if you're shooting in too contrasty a world, you know, it doesn't really turn out that well. But you're going to be looking for a softer light,
yes,
or a more shaded light.
Yeah, it's all very good points. Well, yeah, well made. It's and the flip side for me is also true as well, which is that, you know, I think I've already said it, which you pick the tool for the job. So if you want to, you know, if you want to shoot everything, get a lot of movement, you know, and you need to control the camera. So, okay, well, I need a camera where I can set the shutter speed at, I know, a 15th of a second, and you know, embrace the movement I'll get of subjects and things like that. So, yeah. Interesting stuff. So let's go back to scale on the output then. So you just said a few minutes ago, is there a point at which scaling what did you say? Did you say it's too big? I think you said it's too big.
We're going to have to watch the podcast or listen to it.
Yeah, yeah, well, absolutely. Is
any image diminished by scaling it massively?
I think I have an answer to that question. I think the answer is yes, but it's not a genre of photography, or even a photo that is where the composition is very intimate. You would be something that makes would lose something in scale, and vice versa. Something that is supposed to be, you know, not necessarily a big establishing shot. I mean, an establishing shot for a movie, great, you know, big wide shot. I remember once seeing an exhibition of Edward Butynsky's Oil, and a lot of his work is designed and shot to be very, you know, to be viewed at scale. Yeah. But then I think of something like, for some reason, I've got the mental image that comes is of a Saul Leiter set of photographs. They were of one sort of just taken in and around his apartment in New York, of people that he knew and stuff like that. And I have no idea why this is the thing that jumps into my mind. But, you know, it's good to have seen a lot of photos from a lot of photographers over years, isn't it? But, Saul Leiter used to take photos of some of his girlfriends, right, and partial nudes, and not in a... an obvious way, almost abstracted partial nudes, and I think those are quite intimate photographs, not just because of the relationship between the photographer and the subject, but because of the actual composition as well. And I think if I was to see one of those, you know, 6 feet across, it would have lost something, I think.
But it would have lost intimacy, but would it have gained something else, which is cultural, quote, importance? In other words, if you went into a gallery and looked at one of these intimate imagery and it was 4 feet across by 3 feet high, you would look at it different. It would present itself with the scale and power saying, I'm important, this is an important image. May not be, but I think that there is that, which is when you take a mundane image and you blow it up massive, does the very fact of its kind of mundaneness or what, unremarkable, which we had a podcast weeks ago or months ago, that what we then consider unremarkable or mundane, give it that kind of importance. I refer to, say, Stephen Shore. Stephen Shore?
Totally the name that was in my head as well. That was where I was going next.
Right. So you take a Stephen Shore. I have books of Stephen Shore, some of his early stuff. And you know, they were taken as snapshots, many of them. In fact, he has books of snapshots, you know, menus and from his travels. If you take one of those snapshots, given his work, and blow them up big so that they look like snapshots, but big, it basically transforms one's reaction to what is a snapshot. What is unremarkable? Nothing is unremarkable. In other words, everything has some import when it's presented with a self-consciousness.
That's really, really, really interesting. I mean, just apart from the fact that independently we both grasped for Stephen Shaw, I remember seeing just that sort of thing, a relatively mundane photograph of Stephen Shaw's in a gallery once years and years ago, and it must have been printed, I don't know, like 2 feet across, you know, 3 feet high, something like that, a decent size. And I remember, it's difficult to remember precisely what I thought at the time because, it's such a long time ago, but it, through the fog of memory, I remember thinking it didn't really suit that image. And I remember being a bit, I remember having to think really hard about why, because if you'd had an Eggleston that was scaled to that size, I found those still remain compelling to me. Right, an Eggleston at that size remains compelling. A Shaw at that size, at least a couple that I've seen in that size, a little bit less so. So that's it's a very, very interesting thing to think
about. Let's talk about that. Martin Parr comes to mind as well.
Yeah.
But if you Eggleston's good example, since he was one of these who really. He was very big on color, let's say, on the impact of color in his image. So, you know, there's a famous image of his sort of looking up at a ceiling, I think, the light bulb.
The red ceiling with the wires and the light bulb.
Correct.
Yeah.
See, I remember that image. Impacted me. if you see that at scale, big, it becomes closer to painting than it is to photography.
Okay.
In other words, the form of color and composition and line and perspective, which is really at that size, tends to be in the purview of painting.
Okay.
So that
it is
so
a very graphical image, that one, isn't it? There's no people in it. It is just a red ceiling, and it has it has electrical cables, you know, pinned to it, and
Martin Parr checkered tablecloth with coffee cup with some coffee and cream. You know, those then become transformed by their scale, and if you look at that as a Polaroid, right? You go like, oh, that's cute. Yeah, that you captured that. That's a very nice image. But blown up, it's like, whoa, this is someone who said, this is more than just a red painted ceiling with a light bulb. This is a presentation of color and form. Now, not all images can be that, but there is a difference in presentation which evokes a transformation of how you respond to the image.
I completely agree with that. It is interesting where we go. I'm gonna think about a different type. Same question, different photographer in a moment. But the Martin Parr. I always go back to in my head when I think of Martin Parr. I think of New Brighton. Is the thing that comes to mind. So New Brighton, a place near Liverpool, and he shot, you know, things like in an ice cream shop and fish and chips by the seaside and stuff like that. So it's full of people and very busy. And so those scale quite well. I think the Eggleston stuff for me scales quite well because I don't think Eggleston's photography is of stuff that's mundane. I just think that actually the things you normally think as a subject of a photograph are often absent. And the things that are, you know, like the red ceiling, you know, what is that a photograph of? I find that quite compelling and thought provoking, whereas a snapshot, and I won't single out Stephen Shaw here particularly, But when it is a snapshot of something that's genuinely mundane, then that doesn't scale for me so well. And perhaps if it is a quiet photograph, you know, with you know, a lot of negative space, perhaps, or lacking in energy, a quiet composition, sometimes those don't scale. But let me take this back to...
So conversely, let me do a parallel thing, which really is the opposite, where you have like Robert Frank, you have the Americans, mm-hmm. that work. Some photographs feel better in groups, in folios that are smaller, mm-hmm. like a book or a group exhibit. I was at someone's house, a collector, several years ago, and they had the entire collection of the Americans, all in, I guess they were 8x10s, all framed, all on one big wall, massive wall.
Okay.
In their very, very large house.
I was going to say, yeah.
And it was astonishing. I mean, it was fantastic. By just experiencing the wall and going through the image, you got a sense of travel, of culture, of going somewhere. It transcended the still photo in that they were small and you moved through them. And any one of those images blown up, not that they wouldn't have worked as images, but they wouldn't have the impact they did by the framing device of the multiples of that.
Yeah.
So that was the opposite.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah, very interesting. Right, the other thing I want to talk to you about on this is fashion photography. So, and the thing that's brought this to mind was a David Bailey exhibition I saw some years ago. And, some of those were stuff going back to the 60s, you know, the Gene Shrimpton in New York kind of thing that made both of them famous. And some of them were much more modern, you know, from the 90s, possibly even from the early 2000s. With a very more more contemporary fashion lighting, you know, approach to them. Yeah. And some of those printed what you would say, I'd say near life size, right? Because, where the... Yeah, primarily girls as the models rather than men would have been, you know, 5 feet tall on the print, that sort of thing. So not quite life size, but those sort of things and perhaps the style that really scaled well, became quite powerful and imposing as a set of images.
Yeah, Avedon, same. Mm. Some of his portraits, life size, massive, 8x10 photos have... You know, or Irving Penn's cigarette butts, which I've seen blown up, large platinum prints, 30x40 or 40x50. I think these were platinum prints, so they would be contact printed. They're just staggeringly beautiful. Whereas a little snapshot of a cigarette butt on a sidewalk would not have that scale. This really again drew us closer to painting. And form,
yeah, mm-hmm.
just pure form, light, reflectivity, and of course the metaphor of the cigarette crushed on the sidewalk was more than the cigarette, and I think that is really what we're trying to get at here: is photographs can be more than what they were at capture. In other words, any one of Robert Frank's photos. You could look at them and go, yeah, that's a nice record of people on a bus, you know, but seen in continuum, each one of them has just much more power as they relate to another. On the other hand, when you have something that feels that it just could be thrown away more aesthetically and presented big, means that the photographer, the artist, felt that there was a reason to do it, to present more than what appears initially. And that always really is captivating to me because, you know, when it comes to printing and scale and something that I'm preparing a show for a museum, you know, in a year. And so I've been experimenting with different scale, obviously. And there's costs involved in scaling up and shipping. And so there's logistical imagery, you know, issues to deal with. But I'm also focused on some a show that I intend to do at the end of this year, all of miniatures, all basically 4-inch square pictures. And they're printed on metal. They're a little bit different, but they... I wouldn't have them any other way. In other words, they are like little daguerreotypes. They're like jewels. You lean into them more. You have to really focus. It insists that you focus in on it. You can't just like walk by these things as one can do in a gallery and just go, oh, yeah. No, you really have to stop and look in like a big picture. This is what I've kind of been discovering because I've never worked this small. And a huge image requires you to stop and take it all in.
Yes, yeah.
A small image requires you to do the same thing, but those medium images are different. And so just understanding what works and the power of small is something that I'm exploring right now, and it is liberating. In the same way that we love Instax and that format as well. And again, I've been experimenting with taking some of my AI imagery, some of the imagery that is really neorealistic, and printing them on Instax so they look like Polaroids. And if I show them to anybody, that just because they're printed on a Polaroid, they cannot believe that they are AI generated. If they saw it on a screen, maybe they would go, oh, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. You shared one of the generated images on our Discord the other day, and enormously intricate how you've managed to create that. Although I did have a chuckle to myself, there seemed to be and this sort of temple built into the side of a cliff. There seemed to be the front door and some steps opened up out just to drop down the cliff. But so that made me chuckle a bit. I was like, okay, so there's a clue that it might not be real. But the I like the idea of little jewels that you have to lean into. And I think printing them on metal and things like that will give them a certain texture as well.
Yeah, so medium is very, very different in how they're presented, how they're framed. And, all of this is part of the experience for me of photography, of art, of aesthetics, and engaging with an audience or viewers or collectors, whatever you want to call them. Being aware of scale, being part of the process is really, really exciting. And any image you take, it's worth thinking, is this really interesting as a tiny image or as a large image? Would this work as a photo book that is really, say a 5x7 monograph, but even with those 5x7 pages, making something that is 2 or 3 inches set inside, would that give it a different feeling? We're not talking about what kind of images, and we're not talking about what kind of cameras. We are just purely talking about scale as part of one's creative process and being aware of scale. And something that I did the other day, just here, I was going to make a very big print, which I did, massive, 55-inch print on paper, not for the faint of heart, working, on these big printers. But one of the things that I did here in my studio, because I don't have that big a printer, is I just took the image at scale and I carved it up into using Photoshop and grids and just saving and just okay. printed pieces of them like a mosaic and then laid it out on the floor just to see if it would scale. And it did. So I was That's then able to yeah, then yeah. go, you know, make some adjustments and, you know what I mean? Allow that to happen so that when I output the 450 megabyte file to the printer with all kinds of profiles, we were able after a few weeks to get it absolutely matching what it is I wanted. Point is, you can play with large scale imagery. Even if you don't have the equipment, think about mosaics. Think about putting mm-hmm. things together. Even Instax or Polaroids. I remember, you know, years ago taking portraits of friends of mine where I would literally take like piece of their forehead, piece of their forehead, yeah, yeah. piece of their forehead, like, and adjust it and do a pretty full-scale portrait of them with you know what? Yeah, two or 3 inch Polaroids.
Every portrait is a pack of film. Yeah.
And but again, that becomes part of the process and really fun. So people can work with small desktop printers and basic photo editing to create large scale prints or large scale. Works, I'll call them, that will change the initial instinct that they had when they took the picture. That's my feeling. Mm. And it's worth playing with. So this is meant to be inspiring.
It's inspiring me, I tell you that. Right, okay. So, well, but we should probably draw a line under it there. But that's been a really interesting conversation. Listeners, just in case you didn't know, just in case it doesn't come through, this is one of those days where we're like, what should we talk about today? Let's talk about scale. So we've come into it knowing basically our prep for the show is basically one word. And sometimes, Jeremiah, I don't know about you, but sometimes those are my most favorite conversations because we never know where it's going to go and stuff like that. So I have thoroughly enjoyed this conversation today.
When we get to the picks of the week, let me present mine. This is from, and all of these will be on our show notes, and of course the image associated with them too, but this is from the energy.gov, which is our kind of official government science. It's the Office of Science. They have their own website. Right. And the headline is, "The largest digital camera ever built for astronomy makes its debut."
Okay.
This is a very big camera. It is so big that it's called the LSST. And it's really worth looking at. It weighs 6,000 pounds. It has 3,200 megapixels. It could take an image of a golf ball perfectly sharp from 15 miles away. It has three lenses, the largest being more than 5 feet tall. Right. The lenses open for about 15 seconds to take each photo.
Okay.
And then switches to the next image 5 seconds later, and then they synthesize these. They have specialized filters that they can switch in and out. And it's designed to take photos of more galaxies than there are people on Earth. So there you go when we talk about scale.
Okay.
It makes 8x10 cameras seem head of a pin size. So there you go.
It does a little, doesn't it? Okay, all right. Well, my pick of the week this week actually is not a photography book this week. I'm going to clunk around as I pick up this book, right? Because it's a book. So my pick of the week, actually, I could only get as close as the first two letters, right? So this is a book not on photography, but on philosophy, right? So it starts with a F. It's by a chap called Roger Scruton, and it is called Philosophy, Principles and Problems. And it is one that I'm reading at the moment. I'm part way through. I am enjoying it. It's quite dense. It's supposed to be, a primer, right? Or a summary of a lot of different stuff. But he makes arguments that, if you were learning them in school, would take, 3 weeks to learn as a subject. He makes that argument and concludes it in about three paragraphs. And it's just, I have to stop and take a breath and make notes every couple of paragraphs and reread stuff and things like that. But having said that, so it's not the easiest read in the world, right? But it is quite rewarding. So I'm enjoying it. It's broadening my horizons, and I'm happy to make it my pick of the week. Are you much of a philosopher, Jeremiah?
Yes, I did. Am I a philosopher? Yeah, I wouldn't consider myself a philosopher. But I did study philosophy when I was at university.
Ah, did you? Okay.
And I do. And I tend to read philosophy, every year. I probably grab a couple of books on it. Lately, I've been reading about Stoicism because that seems to be in the ether right now.
It's well, I have quite a lot of sympathy for the Stoic view of the world, actually, to be honest. Yes.
Yeah. Well, it does, engage one in not kind of getting too far over our skis and reacting to things that are actually in our fantasy world or sense of kind of brooding expectations of negativity, rather than just reacting to what is in front of us and how we can manage the world. So it really is a lot of philosophy is about reactivity and how to manage reactivity, because our reactions are often the very thing that screw us up and screw up our relationships.
Indeed.
So philosophy can help there.
Okay. Well, on that life advice, I think we probably should wish for very sound life advice. Thank you very much. And a great conversation about scales. I suppose that if you join those two together, your reaction should be at an appropriate scale. There we go. How about that? Joining two
there
topics
you go,
together.
Yes.
I knew there was a link in there somewhere for my pick of the week.
Now, in closing, I think we need to have a little moment of silence for our ex-podcaster, Emer, who those of us who've been with the podcast for a while should know that Emer passed away last week suddenly and unexpectedly. And we really have a major shout out to her family, which she leaves behind, and her community, which were all shocked and grief-stricken by this, as we were in finding out the news. And we loved her, and we just think she made an amazing contribution. And it's only because she was so pulled in so many directions and so busy trying to do things that she really couldn't find the time to stay with us, though we appreciated every week she was with us. So
we did indeed. It was a sad time when she felt she had to leave the podcast team for all those reasons that you just said. I felt that she really brought a lot to us. Not just brought a lot to us in terms of a different point of view, but in the way that she spoke and the way that she entertained us all, the way that she made us laugh, and it was a joy to spend time with her. Our thoughts go out to,
she will
to
be
her
missed.
Family and her community in Clonmel. Okay.
So on that note, we shall see you again next week. Hopefully, it looks like as we record now, I think Chris is on a ferry.
Yes.
Heading back home.
So, yes, we probably should have said that at the beginning of the show, shouldn't we, really? Chris is not here with us this week, in case nobody noticed. He's not here this week. And he is on a ferry on his way home. And hopefully we'll all three... I'm going to say this. This is going to catch me out. But hopefully all three of us will be together for the show next week. Good. Okay.
Thank you all.
Take care, folks. Goodbye.
You've been listening to The Future of Photography. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your other podcasts. Find the show notes and more information at thefutureofphotography.com.